Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thanks, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script. There's a powerful play on Broadway. Actually, it's a play with song, with a powerful coming-of-age story set in an all-black, all-boys private high school. The play is Choir Boy. It has a wonderful ensemble cast that centers around Ferris, who leads the choral group and who happens to be gay and proud of it. His nemesis is Bobby, who in the very first scene during a public choral performance taunts him rather homophobically. With me today is the actor who plays Bobby, J. Quentin Johnson, who at the age of 24 now, is making his second appearance on Broadway, his first in a little musical called Hamilton.
Yes.
To talk about his character in Choir Boy and his own path to Broadway, I welcome J. Quentin Johnson to Off Script. I'm going to call you Q. That's what everybody calls you.
Please do. Yes.
Okay. So, wow, congratulations on your role.
Thank you, Bobby.
It's a great role, and it's a wonderfully written play by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who got the Oscar last year for the adapted screenplay for Moonlight.
Oh, yes.
And the play doesn't really waste any time getting right into it. In my introduction, I said that your character taunts Ferris homophobically. Mm-hmm. Within, I think, 2 minutes of the play, you're calling him sissy and faggot, and it takes off from there.
Yes.
So tell us about... Don't tell us about Ferris. I want to know about Bobby and why he's got this thing for Ferris, because Ferris isn't trying to hide the fact that he's gay. Mm-hmm. He's out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other guys in the school are kind of comfortable with the fact that Ferris is, well, just Ferris.
Yeah.
Except Bobby.
Yeah. I think that Bobby, at least what I've worked out for myself as the actor, is that I don't think that Bobby has a problem with Ferris. I think he has a problem with what Ferris represents in the institution, right? Bobby is short-sighted, narrow-minded in terms of he thinks that there is a certain way that things are supposed to be done, and Ferris represents the antithesis of the way those things should be done. And he thinks there's a problem with that and foresees a larger issue with that that doesn't just have to do with himself. He thinks that there will be some sort of larger systematic issue if he is allowed to stay and no one says anything about it or does anything about it. And that is kind of his driving force throughout the play, is that he thinks something is very wrong and it needs to be corrected.
But they come from different backgrounds. I mean, Bobby comes from a rather privileged background.
Yeah, Bobby's the nephew of the headmaster, and his father, Bobby's father, significantly financially backs the school. So yes, but Bobby has a legacy.
Right.
He's grown up with, again, he knows the heart of the institution by rote, right? Not necessarily because he's studious, but because he's lived with it. He knows it. He's breathed it. And again, it's for those reasons of having that privilege in this case, meaning an understanding of something, right, and an access to something that not everyone has, right? We have characters in the show that can barely afford to pay for school, right?
And Ferris being one of them, right? He's on full scholarship.
A lot of, you know, and Bobby doesn't see... He kind of doesn't really understand what it takes for those to go through acquiring a scholarship and what that might mean for them, right? There's terms of scholarships, right? You have to keep your grades up. You really have to follow the rules. And Bobby doesn't have that pressure weighing on him. He does have other pressures, but I think where the conflict stems from is that the pressure that he deals with is not the pressure that Ferris deals with. It's not the pressure that David deals with. It's not the pressure that any of the other boys deal with. But you put them kind of all in one space and ask them to, you know, get along or to work together when they have such different perspectives. And we don't spend a lot of time trying to understand those different perspectives in terms of the students toward one another. And that's where I think the conflict mainly erupts from.
The thing also that I thought was interesting about the difference between Bobby and Ferris was that Ferris is fatherless, okay? He's got an absent father, I think, because he only talks to his mother on the phone. But Bobby really doesn't have a mother.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got one character who's sort of fatherless, and you've got Bobby who's motherless. Mm-hmm. He's very defensive about his fact that his mother's – he doesn't really have his own mother anymore. Mm-hmm. He's got a stepmother. How did that figure in?
I think that there is a large tie-in with parental figures, especially mothers, in the show, and what the idea of a mother represents to these young black men, and how these young men deal with the absence of their mothers in different ways, right? Ferris struggles to just get his mom to show up for something that is so as defining of a life event as graduating high school, struggles to get her to be there. And, you know, David has issues with his father and mom in terms of just being able to talk to them, right?
For people who haven't seen the play, David is another character who's more or less a fledgling divinity student.
Yes.
He studies the Bible a lot.
Yes, he does.
Right.
He's now a devout, in the course of our play, is a very devout Christian on course to be a pastor. He hasn't always been that way. This is a new course he's taken as you join us in the play. And so again, all these young men are struggling with different relationships with their parents. And I think that because there is an absence of a nurturing aspect, if that's, you know, a mother, or even if that's any parental figure, right, regardless of sex, that is there to say, hey, I see the struggles that you're going through. And this person is also going through a struggle that may not look like yours, whatever that guidance is. I think that we all struggle to find that, in place of the institution, right? I think the institution touts itself as that, as mm-hmm. guidance, as we're making you to be, you know, the Drew men of tomorrow. And I think institution is oftentimes absent of true guidance, right? For especially for these young men, but for any young person, any person, anywhere, institution kind of sets to say, well, here are the ground rules. Here's the way that it's always been done. Do it like that. And that should guide you to be the best you can be. And I don't think that is true. And that's very evident in the struggles that the young men face, especially pertaining to the parents, because since they are sent away to boarding school, parents aren't there. And if there's been an active choice to say, hey, go away for a semester and be at this other place, I'm not even going to be present to talk about right. homework or to talk about, you know, what right. happened at school that day. So again, it's the absence of that nurturing thing that, again, I think is very consciously channeled through mothers, but that also applies and stands almost in opposition to the idea of institution.
Right. In case you're just joining us, I'm Dan Dwyer, the host, and the program is Off Script. My guest today is J. Quinton Johnson, Q, who is now appearing as Bobby in the phenomenally successful play The Choir Boy. The thing that's most distinctive about Choir Boy, besides dealing with issues of growing up and institutions and how an individual relates, as you say, to the institution and the whole notion of masculinity, is how it incorporates the story with song, or how it incorporates song with story. Mm-hmm. And I think there are, 10 numbers in it? Six of which are either spiritual or mm-hmm. folk or gospel-based, and then there's a couple that are popular songs. Mm-hmm. What really strikes me is that how the songs somehow express sometimes the group mentality, mm-hmm. sometimes they express the individual consciousness of a particular character, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're just flights of fancy. Mm-hmm. You, I think, have the best number, which is the New Editions number.
Oh, excellent. Boys to Men. Yeah.
Boys to Men, mm-hmm. which is kind of funny because that's really the point of the
sure.
play.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's hilarious because it's you're showboating, and it's sort of like a little comic relief because mm-hmm. at that point in the play how much of that is you? How much of that is Q in that number?
100%. Oh, it's 100% me all the time.
Now, you do. You also, the other thing that we should talk about is your sidekick in the play.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah,
you got
yeah,
a cool
junior.
Sidekick.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you sort
yeah.
of are the little – you're not the little, but you're sort of the BMOC on campus.
Sure.
And you're
Bobby
wrong. And you're
himself,
Bobby,
yeah.
He thinks of himself as the BMOC. And like any big man on campus, he's got a sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sidekick's name?
Junior.
Junior. And
yeah.
he sort of like – he sort of like goes along with whatever you want to do.
Played so well by Nick Ash.
Okay, so I'm trying to set up the number of how you do this, the Boys to Men number, because it's really the high point, one of the high points of the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, Boys to Men, I think is Bobby and Junior trying, right? I mean, Junior does not oppose as vehemently as Bobby does to a lot of the things that are happening in the show. But I think for Bobby, this is a chance to say, okay, I mean, in Bobby's mind, he's been trying to have fun the whole time, right?
Right.
He's been trying to do the things that he thinks, by function, make him a Drew man, and protesting the things that seem counter to the idea of a Drew man. And so,
Drew's the name of the academy where all the guys go.
Yes, Charles R. Drew Preparatory Academy for Boys. And I think that in this moment, you know, all these young men, you know, they're in the choir, right? And I think there is a joy, as we kind of see in a more dramatic sense, there's a joy that these young men get from singing, right? We see that in our shower scene right after a confrontation between Bobby and David. That these young boys...
Is this the motherless child?
This is motherless child,
I love that. I love that.
Yeah, motherless child. The scene that takes place in the shower is a it allows the audience to kind of peer into what it's talked about at the top of the show, right? It's like the choir has allowed the school, has been a main source of funding for the school. It's allowed the school to stay open, to stay afloat because of... You know, these young men who all those years ago, you know, started singing in the shower, and a headmaster heard that and was like, yeah, no, we gotta monetize that to help the school, grow and build. And so you get a sense that with these spirituals and even the secular songs like Boys to Men, that singing is healing for these young men, just as singing these Negro spirituals were to, you know, the slaves hundreds of years ago. So in the same way that, you know, per the debate, right, it's like these songs soothe, the argument is that these songs, their main purpose was to, you know, soothe our souls, soothe our hearts. And I think that you're seeing a modern day version of that with Boys to Men, of just all of the strife that Bobby has gone through is healed, at least while he's singing and performing the song, because he does find real joy in that.
Right. Even though the songs sometimes feel like flights of fantasy, or take the external dialogue and make it an internal phenomenon among the characters, it all seems just to spring seamlessly from the action.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how long it took, because you've got a fabulous ensemble you're working with, for all of you guys to get together and to make it look so natural, even though black guys at a high school breaking into song don't happen every day.
Right, I mean, I think the rehearsal process was about 3 weeks, 3 weeks and change. We had 5 days to tech the show.
You're kidding.
Yeah. As theater practitioners, you have to get it done, right? And that's the – it's kind of nice to have a truncated rehearsal process, because it kind of gets you out the gate faster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the nature of working with, you know, a theater company like MTC, right? They have multiple shows a season, so you really only have resources for such a short amount of time. But, yeah, when you get people of this caliber in a room together that understand what they have to individually bring to the piece, you really don't need that long to allow things to gel and congeal in the way that, you know, I hope that they have and continue to do on stage.
And how much of the choreography is you guys doing the choreography as you're doing the song that occurs naturally, as opposed to being directed to it? You're working with a great choreographer.
Yeah, Amelia Brown.
But the stage movement for this play, including the song sequences, is really, really amazing.
Yeah.
Particularly what you, I mean, when your hands and your feet turn into the percussive section we should say all of it's done in a cappella.
Yes.
Yeah. For someone who hasn't
no
seen the play, let's get that straight too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No accompaniment in the show. No live instrumentation. I think what Jason Michael Webb, who arranged all of our the pieces that we sing in the show, and Camille Brown, I think between the two of them, and then even Ricky Tripp, right? I think Camille and Ricky, who assisted Camille on this piece. They have, all three of them have such a mind for what the other is doing, right? Like, you know, Camille is not someone who comes in and is only thinking about the way something looks movement-wise, right? She's thinking about the story. She's thinking about your intentions. She's thinking about the music. And so because all of those people, all of those creatives, as I mentioned, came in knowing what they had to do and had a mind for what other people needed to do in the room, it really came up organically. And then I think us as actors are able to just bring the pieces of ourselves that are relevant to any of them, right? So if Jason needs... if he's written something on the page, but there's room to interpret it yourself, he says, have at it. You know, same with Tripp and Terrell, right?
Tripp being the director.
Exactly. So it's like you have what you have on the page, right, that Terrell has ironed out, that Tripp is trying to dissect and figure out how to stage, and that Camille is looking at and saying, well, yeah, here are my ideas. Here's the movement that I like. But then, you know, you get in the room and you start doing certain bits of movement and someone breaks out into something, she's like, yeah, let's do that. Mm-hmm. Or it's like, yeah, you do that and you do that and you do that. So it is collaborative in the sense that they have, you know, they do all of their work beforehand. They come into the room. We bring what we bring as the actors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mix that into a pot and then you throw that up on stage and that's what you're seeing. So right. I think that melding, right, the seamlessness of it, I think, is born out of a very collaborative process with all of our creatives.
Right. So we've talked about Bobby's journey. Let's talk about Q's journey. Mm-hmm. At the age of 23, now you're 24, you've had two Broadway shows under your belt. Mm-hmm. And yours is a fascinating story. I read an interview of you in the New York Times a while back, and I guess the two keys to your story are Michael Jackson and the play Hamilton itself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get from Athens, Texas?
Athens, Texas, yes.
Little town in East Texas to East Broadway Texas. In a pretty short period of time.
It's a long story, but I'll try to.
Well, we've got about 12 minutes.
I'll get the greatest hits. So I left Athens in, I guess that would have been 2012 is when I graduated high school. I had been doing theater there for 2 to 3 years. I remember I did a play called, a musical called Once Upon a Mattress. I
was it's great. Yeah. What was your role?
Night number four.
Of course. So night number four.
Yeah, ensemble for that show. It was the first musical I had ever done, but I did that in high school and kind of caught the bug. So went through all of the things that one goes through when, you know, searching out collegiate study.
Sure.
Right. Ended up at the University of Texas at Austin after I graduated in 2012. They had a musical theater initiative program they were starting up and a lot of money to throw at that. So I got a pretty hefty scholarship to study musical theater at the University of Texas at Austin. And so I was there for 2 years and was concluding my second year doing a production of Oklahoma at Zilker Hillside Theater in Austin, Texas. I was playing Will Parker at the
time.
When a film breakdown came out that my college professors heard about, and they knew the casting director, and they sent me an email while I was doing the show over the summer and said, hey, we think you should go in for this movie. I'd never done film before, never auditioned for a film. I was, you know, hardcore musical theater.
Of course.
And they were like, yeah, we think this would be, a nice component to your study here at UT. And so I went in for the film, and I was cast in the film. Yeah, so the first film audition was a Richard Linklater film entitled Everybody Wants Some. We shot that in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going back to school after we finished that movie, and the musical theater initiative that I mentioned, the funding was being cut from that. So I kind of took all of that as a sign to leave school and try to take that one large professional credit that I now had and try to turn that into a career. So I stayed in Austin for a year after that, working around town at, you know, places like Zach Theater, which is there in Austin, Texas, a couple of other small professional theaters there. And it wasn't until that movie got ready to come out that I went to LA for the first time, and I saw that movie on the Paramount lot, and that's where I met two of my biggest components to my team, my managers. I met them there in Los Angeles for that, and they were like, hey, we think you need to be out in L.A. So I packed up, moved to L.A. all within like a month or so.
You're like 19 years old now?
I would have been.
Something like that?
Yeah, 20, maybe 21.
No, it's just a couple of years ago, really.
Just a couple of years ago, yeah. Because I was cast in Everybody Wants Some when I was 20. So it was right after I turned 20. And the movie didn't come out until I was getting ready to turn 21, I believe.
And so how did the Dirty Dancing thing show up?
So that, I mean, it's coming. Yeah, okay. I was in L.A. after all of that, waited a year for the movie to come out, was in L.A. with my managers, and they were sending me on all types of auditions, right? They, like, flew me out to L.A., put me up in a nice hotel to get me to start taking meetings. I hadn't really, you know, hadn't taken meetings, auditioned at all in L.A. And one of the first meetings I had was with a head of casting over at ABC, which is who aired Dirty Dancing. And so as a product of that meeting, I had an audition, again, a random audition for like my first 3 days in L.A. that they were, my managers were paying for. And it was for Dirty Dancing, Johnny Castle. They wanted me to come in for Johnny Castle just because they knew I sang and danced and all this kind of stuff. Just an introductory meeting.
Let me interrupt because I want to get the full story. But speaking of dancing, the New York Times article reported that you learned how to dance. You taught yourself how to dance by watching Michael Jackson videos.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Back when I was in that one, after doing Once Upon a Mattress, I ended up choreographing like a small stint of Thriller for another one of our musicals at some point in time, and hit my time at Athens High School. But that was the first time that I had ever. Like, I'd always danced, like, as a kid watching the videos younger, but it wasn't until I had to then choreograph, you know, bits of his movement that I was like, okay, I guess, you know, still never would classify myself as a dancer, but that's kind of how I learned to move. And I never danced for Dirty Dancing, which is interesting.
Right.
But you know, again, Andy Blankenbuehler choreographed that, so it's like that's who I had to.
But where does the Hamilton thing now figures into the Dirty Dancing thing?
Because Andy Blankenbuehler, choreographer
who got the Tony Award.
Yes, Dirty Dancing ended up. I obviously didn't play Johnny Castle, but I ended up getting cast as an auxiliary role that didn't exist in the original film. And part of the attack of that was that Andy Blankenbuehler was going to choreograph. And I had already been head over heels for Hamilton at this point, but Hamilton hadn't – it had been open for a number of months, but hadn't quite gotten – like we hadn't gotten to Tony nominations yet.
Right.
So it was still on that bubble of like a lot of people are talking about it and love it, but like it, you know, the historic 16 nominations hadn't happened yet.
Right.
That happened while I was on set with Andy for Dirty Dancing.
Right.
It was nerding out about it the whole time and was trying to figure out a way to breach the topic of conversation without, you know, annoying him or bothering
him. And you know the whole score by heart?
Yeah. Especially now.
How many kids do you think in America know the Hamilton score by heart? A lot.
You would think a lot. Yeah. It's like as soon as they start going and they like miss a word or two and it's like go listen to it again. You know, or people that tout themselves as knowing it. I guess I'm a pure.
So how did you let Andy know that you knew Hamilton pretty cold?
I was going to go see Hamilton. Hamilton was the first Broadway show I ever saw, and Richard Linklater got me.
But that's
a
good start.
A great start, right? and so Richard Linklater got me a ticket to go see that, but I couldn't go because Andy needed me for a rehearsal for Dirty Dancing in North Carolina, and so. I don't think I had the courage quite to say anything about that then, but I think as we continue to shoot, and again, that's where the New York Times story came in. I don't think I ever really said anything about it until I played the opening number and wrapped all the parts for him randomly on a dinner break on set. And so the conversation then kind of was born out of that whole instance.
This is sort of like, I can do that out of Chorus Line, you know.
Similar, yeah. But it's like, yeah, all the conversation kind of happened after that huge moment, and the cast was there cheering me on because they all knew I was such a fan of his and a fan of Hamilton and Bring It On and In the Heights. And they were obviously getting ready to cast, you know, the Chicago production and the L.A. production. So once he knew that was kind of like in my wheelhouse, like it was a very fiery conversation throughout the rest of the run. Right, he got my phone number. I got a pair of house seats to go see Hamilton with the original cast before the Tonys. And then wasn't ultimately cast until I had a call back in Los Angeles months after that.
And the two roles you play. In the first act, you play
Hercules Mulligan.
And in the second act, you play
James Madison.
That's great.
James Madison.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. I replaced.
So you're part of the when they write the history, when they do the history books on Hamilton. Are you part of the second Broadway cast or the third Broadway cast?
Yeah, I replaced the the original.
So you're the second Broadway. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
It's crazy.
So, so at the age of 21 now, 20...
That would have been 22.
You're 22. You find yourself in the hottest, probably the hottest Broadway show so far of the 21st century, arguably one of the most influential musicals in the history of the American musical theater. It's pretty cool.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that was 2 years after my first film, so...
What was your... what's your favorite part of the Hamilton... score, the Hamilton, the whole
Yorktown
story.
Rap. Yeah. The Yorktown rap, absolutely. Yeah. Because, I mean, I love the whole idea of musicalizing the, one of the big battles of the American Revolution. But to do it in that way, to make it just this, like, aggressive flex rap is just, I mean, that's so innovative. So much of the show is so innovative, right, to take these moments that we know peripherally, you know, through our history books and make them musical moments that arguably is music that not a lot of Broadway goers know, right? But that we buy it because it feels so accurate to you know what we imagine the fervor that our founding fathers had.
But heretofore, I mean, how many kids, let alone black kids, would give a damn about Alexander Hamilton?
Yeah, I mean, all I ever knew about him, and all that was ever required for us to know about him was the duel.
Right.
Right, so to musicalize that whole thing, right, to tell the whole story from beginning, middle, end, make that duel the ending of it. It's just so smart. It's so incredibly smart. But that's the storytelling that we should have, right, as people who are telling stories as a profession, not only as a profession, but at such a high level in Broadway and in film and television. Like, that is the, Lynn's at the bar incredibly high, but that especially in 2019, that should be the base, right? We should continue to grow and create things that have that same level of innovation or more going forward. And again, I think that's why I was so drawn to something like Choir Boy.
Do you think that Hamilton, the effect of Hamilton on kids, I mean, kids in grammar school, kids in junior high, high school, is underestimated? Or do you think it's really something that's a phenomenon beyond what educators can really appreciate? Or do you think educators in school know what they've got as a device to get kids involved?
I would hope so. I mean, again, growing up in Athens, I don't have a ton of perspective of – I mean, growing up in Athens – 10 years ago now, arguably, is when I started high school.
Yeah.
So I don't have the perspective of educators now in those spaces and in spaces outside of Texas. So I would like to think that educators understand the powerful tool that something like that can be, right? And not all of it is 100% historically accurate, because again, what we're doing is we're dramatizing, we're telling stories. But it can be such a useful tool to get kids to create a curiosity, right? To say, well, like, here's a guy that knew a whole bunch about all of this stuff that we have to learn in school, and look at the product that he made, something that now entertains large groups of people. But it's hard to say, because, I say that from my perspective on the inside of something that is so huge, and it's only huge, larger to me, because I'm on the inside and I'm a practitioner here on Broadway. So, of course, that's going to seem like the largest thing. But there's times I go home to Athens, Texas, and people don't know what Hamilton is.
Yeah.
So to know that exists on that spectrum, it's hard to pinpoint what the effect is to, I don't know if there's tons of kids that are at my high school right now that even know about the musical. I hope that it can spread its reach to even those like small towns and places like Texas or anywhere else in the country for that matter. But
Well, congratulations for being part of the Hamilton cultural phenomenon. Thank you. Congratulations on your role as Bobby.
Thank you.
In The Choir Boy.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for coming, Q, on Off Script.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. The station is Robin Hood Radio, the smallest NPR station in the nation. We are listener-supported. If you've liked this program and others that you listen to on it, please go to robinhoodradio.com. Go to the support page and express your appreciation. Thanks for listening.
underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from John & Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.